here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
We are back together, sharing Evening Under Lamplight. You and me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. And by the way, we ought to mention, with pride and modesty, of course, that Cambridge 105 has just won the Bronze Award for Marketing and Station Sound of the Year in the first Community Radio Awards. So well done to listeners, and to all those who work so hard behind the scenes here at Cambridge 105 and behind the mics. And now, here's our wee contribution to behind the mic broadcasting as we continue our journey through the Inferno with Dante, attending this week to Canto 10, where we learn something about heresy and cars starting out in the car park. And we learn something about heresy and its boxed-in nature and its relationship to failed communication and violence. It's not quite what you'd expect. You are invited to attend. Recall that last time we saw how Dante and Virgil overcame the resistance of the fiends guarding the gate that led into the city of Dis, that perverted community that comprises all the rest of hell, lower hell, we might call it. Dante was threatened by the Furies, representing on one level the piercing cries of the guilty conscience which assault us as we proceed further into our journey deep within ourselves. And the Furies threatened Dante with Medusa, that snake-haired monster, the very sight of whom turns you into stone, or in other words, when we begin to hear the screams of our conscience and have to face up to all the things we've done wrong on a deep level, we are in danger of being turned to stone, too petrified to proceed further. But Dante is saved from this fate by the divine messenger in the figure of Mercury, the psychopomp, who leads the soul to the underworld, to a world of darkness and trickery, but ultimately into good fortune. And so Dante and Virgil enter the city through the gates. But don't expect a city in the sense of streets and houses. No, this city consists of a further series of concentric circles, each one a little lower down in the funnel that forms hell in Dante's myth, a little lower down and a little smaller. The first circle in this lower hell, just inside the walls of the city, consists of a large plain filled with tombs, stone boxes that hold the dead. And scattered around the tombs are flames of fire, heating the tombs like red-hot iron before it is worked on an anvil. "Who's here?" Dante asks Virgil. "These are the souls of the heretics," he replies. And then comes a dramatic scene with two of the souls entombed here who represent the heresy of materialism, denying the existence of the soul after death. Well, as we usually do, let's first run through what happens in this canto and then try to see what significance these events might have for us. Let's promenade over there. Dante and Virgil are proceeding along a secreto calle, a hidden path, between the city walls and the tormented souls in those tombs surrounded by flames. Virgil explains that in the area where they are walking lie the Epicureans, those who hold that when the body dies, the soul dies too. In other words, these people are materialists, who do not believe in the immateriality of the soul. The only thing that matters for them is the material life on earth. As Dante speaks to Virgil, a voice suddenly comes out of one of the tombs, a polite but imperious voice, recognizing Dante from his accent as a fellow Tuscan, asking him to be kind enough to stop here for a while. Dante, startled, looks at Virgil, who directs him to turn around and look at the tomb, out of which there rises the shade of Farinata degli Uberti, a noted military and political leader from the generation just before Dante's. With a gentle push, Virgil encourages Dante to approach Farinata, but warns him, "Choose your words with care." Farinata immediately asks Dante who his ancestors were. That's what matters to this materialist, one's position in society. Dante gives him a full account, at which Farinata raises his eyebrows in the kind of haughty look that first accepts that this descendant of noble ancestors is worthy of his time, but then quickly dismisses any real concern, since Dante's family belonged to the party Farinata opposed. "Bitter enemies of mine they were," he says, "and of my ancestors, and of my party. I had to scatter them not once but twice." In other words, they opposed him, and so he was obliged to remove them. Nothing must get in this aristocrat's way. They returned from exile, and so he had to expel them a second time. They're real pests, you see. But Dante can taunt him in return that although his family's party returned from both expulsions from Florence, Farinata's party never recovered from the second time they were expelled. This dialogue, which looks to be turning nasty, is suddenly interrupted as a second figure arises from the tomb, only showing his face down to his chin, not his whole torso. Perhaps he's kneeling. This is Cavalcante dei Cavalcanti, the father of Dante's good friend Guido, a fellow poet of the Dolce Stil Nuovo school. Cavalcante looks around, expecting to see his son Guido accompanying Dante, and when he doesn't see him, he begins to weep, and he asks Dante, "If it be great genius that carries you along through this blind jail, where is my son? Why is he not with you?" Dante begins to explain that he is journeying through hell, guided by Virgil, and adds, the Italian is ambiguous, that Guido disdained Virgil, or perhaps he disdained Beatrice and the kind of spiritual love she stands for, since Guido's poetry did not raise love to such heights. Hearing his son spoken of in the past tense, Cavalcanti springs to his full height. "What?" he asks. "Is my son now dead?" Dante hesitates to answer, and Cavalcanti collapses like a puppet, and like Jaco and Plutus, whom we have seen earlier, who collapsed once the energy had gone out of them. Cavalcanti sinks back into the tomb, and we hear no more of him. I guess, like Paul in the Beatles song, he's just down.
You tell lies, thinking I can see. You can't cry, cause you're laughing at me. I'm down. I'm down. I'm down. How can you laugh when you know I'm down? When you know I'm down. Man, my ring, woman throws it away. Same old thing happen every day. I'm down. I'm down. I'm down. How can you laugh when you know I'm down? When you know I'm down.
That's the Beatles messing around. Back to Cavalcanti. Cavalcanti sinks back into the tomb, you remember, and Farinata immediately resumes where he had left off, having completely ignored the presence of the other shade. Dante had taunted him with the reminder that his party had not returned from their second exile. Farinata comments that the defeat of his party gives him more pain than the burning tomb he's in. But he achieves a kind of revenge by predicting that in less than 50 months, Dante too will know exile. Dante explains that Farinata's party is persecuted so severely because of the great slaughter they brought about at the Battle of Montaperti in 1260, where troops under Farinata brought about such massacre and butchery that stained the waters of the river Arbia red. Farinata backs out of full responsibility, claiming that he was not the only one who took part in this battle. And he adds, in self-justification, that in fact he was the only one who spoke up after the battle to oppose the plan to raze Florence to the ground. He was a great man in his way, a true patriot, who, when it came to it, could hold the good of his state higher than the desires of his party. Dante changes the subject now and asks how it is that the dead shades can see past and future events on Earth, but not present events. He's thinking particularly of why Cavalcanti did not know that his son is still alive in April 1300, the time the poem takes place. In fact, in April 1300, Guido, just returned to Florence from exile, was lying ill in bed and died 4 months later in August. Well, Farinata explains that the souls in hell can see, but with defective vision. They can make out only what's at a distance. They cannot see the present moment. This applies to all the souls in the Inferno, but as we'll see in a few minutes, it's particularly appropriate to learn about here with the heretics. Now Dante understands why Cavalcanti was so upset when Dante hesitated, and he asks Farinata to explain to Cavalcanti, as if such a proud man would ever stoop to bearing messages, to explain that Guido is still alive. Dante had hesitated only because he was astonished that the father did not know that. And finally, Dante asks if Farinata can tell him who else is buried here in this tomb. But aristocratic Farinata names only the Emperor Frederick II and a cardinal. He wants us to know the kind of company he keeps here. Anyone of lower social standing is not worth mentioning. Dante and Virgil walk on, Dante bothered by Farinata's words about his future exile. Virgil assures him that all will be explained later on when Beatrice leads him through heaven. The two men then turn left and head towards the circle of the violent against others, immersed in the boiling blood of the river Phlegethon. Now that we have followed the literal sequence of events, let's go back and see what the events can tell us about the nature of heresy. Heresy is an intellectual sin, different from all the other sins in the Inferno, which have to do with how we behave, how we act to one another, to ourselves, to God and nature. But heresy is about how we think. Technically, heresy is the adherence to a set of beliefs at variance with orthodox beliefs. That's a neat definition, isn't it? But it begs the question, that is, it does not answer the question of what is heresy, since we can't define a deviation from orthodoxy without first defining what orthodoxy is. Orthodoxy is technically the right belief, but again, how do we define right? Who's to decide what is the right thing to believe? I think the main problem for us today is that the authorities who have set themselves up over the centuries to determine what is right belief have abused their power so much that we always mistrust what they're telling us. 300 years ago, the Enlightenment, with its scientific attention to the evidence of our senses, waged a campaign against these authorities, whose rules often seemed much too far from our experience of the real world. And today, it becomes increasingly hard to put faith in an orthodoxy formulated almost exclusively by white European men, out of touch with the experience of so many people throughout the world, though people like the present Pope are trying to adjust matters. Well, if we don't trust the authorities to formulate right belief, where then do we find right belief? Well, in ourselves, I suppose. We are left, each of us, to determine what is right. Fair enough, in principle, perhaps. But we're prone to self-delusion, to adhering to an idea because it allows us to do things we like to do. Or we adhere to an idea because we think it will please our ego and make us look important, or because we hope to find security in adhering to social conventions in all their limitations. We need a great deal of inner training to be able to quiet the pleadings of the ego and social conventions and to open ourselves to that still small voice within us that indeed confirms what is true and right. If we can do that, then yes, we must hold to those truths, even in the face of what orthodoxy tells us. Even the church would agree here, I think. But as Thoreau said, this is hard. And because, however strong we feel the truth in our heart, there is always the chance that we've misunderstood, or only partially understood, or cannot find a clear way to express what we've perceived. Our vision and our understanding are so limited. And this is why we need other people's views. We need to play our understanding of the truth against others' understanding, and each of us share and adjust and expand our perceptions. Only then can we dare to call our shared perceptions orthodoxy. But the heretic isn't open like this. The heretic is the person who clings to his or her own perception of the truth in opposition to orthodoxy, that is, in opposition to a larger communal understanding of what is true. The word heresy is related to the word adhere. Heretics adhere to their own view. They cling to their own view, rejecting the community's understanding. Such heretical attitudes take us back to the chaotic state of affairs described in the Book of Judges, where every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Maybe it would clarify things more if, instead of speaking of orthodoxy and right belief, we drew upon Gil Bailey's definition. Orthodoxy, he proposes, is not concerned so much with conformity to a set of beliefs, as with the issue of how well or how poorly we have interpreted existence so as to live fully and deeply and meaningfully, relating to the real world. In other words, are we open to what is really there in the world in all its complexity, and thereby live a full life full of meaning and depth? Or do we narrow or distort our view of reality and thus narrow and distort our own lives? Moving away from right belief to an openness to reality is helpful, since in this canto about heresy, there actually is no mention of theology. Dante is interested in the consequences of heresy, Gil Bailey points out, not in its detail and not in its theological formulation. In other words, not theory, but what, experientially, does it do to your life? And let's ask now what Dante can do to help bring these ideas to life through his poetic imagery. Our first image is of Dante and Virgil beginning to walk into the city of Dis. Lo mio maestro, io dopo le spalle. My master first, and me right behind him. We are reminded at the start that Dante willingly submits to Virgil's lead here. A heretic might say, here, let me try this way. I think I can find my own way around this place. But Dante puts himself immediately into what we might call an orthodox position, admitting that Virgil has the knowledge and power to lead him the right way.
I will follow him wherever he may go. There isn't an ocean too deep, a mountain so high it can't keep me away. I must follow him. Ever since he touched my hand, I knew. Well,
All right, some light relief from the 14-year-old Little Peggy March, I Will Follow Him, number one in 1963. Not quite the song Dante is singing here in the city of Dis, but well, close enough. The first souls Dante and Virgil come across inside the walls of the city are these heretics. It's not hard to imagine that these are people who have seen Medusa and been turned to stone. They can see only one point of view, and so it's no wonder that they're doomed to be boxed in and suffering the torments of this narrowness they have chosen for themselves. Virgil had said that you cannot enter the city of Dis sans ira, without anger. It seems that once you do enter, you can't proceed any further without first confronting heresy and assessing how far you too might be heretical, how ready you might be to opening to new understandings of the reality of things that might come to you through what you see here in hell in your deeper self. Dante, as usual, gives us something we'd never expect. These stone tombs surrounded by fire. Heresy is an act of boxing ourselves in. We set out lines of demarcation. I believe this, and I won't hear of any alternative. This is not the healthy activity of intellectual discernment and choice. We're not just drawing lines, but erecting walls to confine ourselves within. I suppose, literally, a tomb is a kind of defensive wall erected to stop the worms and the elements from getting to the corpse. Metaphorically, then, these people are afraid that any outside influence may corrupt them. They feel the need to protect themselves from those they don't agree with. This is not a full, deep, and meaningful engagement with reality. So, the torment comes from flames outside the stone tomb of the heretic. And these are not flames that purify. They are flames that bake the soul, killing off the life inside it. So that's heresy, boxed into baking tombs. But now, which of the many heresies was Dante going to give us an example of in this poem? Most of the Catholic heresies centered around the nature of God, such as the question of whether Jesus was God or just a very good man. But Dante ignores all of these and hones in on what's probably the central belief, certainly for a poem set among the souls of the dead, not the nature of God, but the nature of the human soul. And here's where we find the materialist heresy, which says that the soul dies when the body dies. In other words, materialism holds that there is no life after death. This is the heresy of Epicureanism. All we have is the life of this world. We today might be inclined to depict materialism through images of amassing material goods, conspicuous consumption, that sort of thing. Classical Epicureans went beyond that and defined the true life of pleasure as involving the joys of the intellect and the imagination. Dante ignores these standard ideas of materialism and shows us something much more sinister. For him, materialism is expressed through images of family pride, political and military strife, and failure of communication. The point is that materialists will be able to see no further than genetic and social conditioning, and consider that these factors are what determine a person's identity. These aspects are what the philosophers would call accidentals. They determine the roles we adopt as we go through life, but they are not our true, deeper self. So the materialists will always place much more importance on family pride, social propriety, and party politics, and will always, it seems to me, create misunderstandings and misconceptions and miscommunications. You remember that we spoke of the way orthodoxy represents an attitude that checks our own understanding of the world against the understanding of others, just to see if we need to adjust or reconsider our assumptions or perceptions. In an earlier work, The Convivio, Dante does just that by reminding us that all the poets and thinkers from all traditions in history have upheld the idea that there is a life after death. Dante says, to suppose that all of these people were mistaken would be an absurdity. Now, this materialist heresy is primarily represented in the Inferno through the figure of Farinata degli Uberti, a man obsessed with his position in the world and, more importantly, the position of his family and his political party. Farinata was indeed a great man on the level of English leaders like the Duke of Marlborough or Wellington. Dante addresses him by the formal voi rather than the informal tu, which he uses with most of the other sinners he meets in hell. So Farinata is not deluded about his greatness. He was great. It's just that now, after death, is no longer the time to be concerned about such things. But remember, heretics by their very nature have created for themselves a world where they are right and anyone who is not them and not of their party is wrong. A heretic involved in politics like Farinata is boxed into this us-them opposition and can do nothing else but relive the battles he has fought, still glorying in his victories and still pained by his defeats. In fact, remember, he says that the thought of his party's defeat is a greater pain than the burning tomb he's in. But the defeat and the burning are actually the same thing. The burning torment comes precisely from his inability to let go of the wins and losses, the accidentals of his life on earth. The heretic is so concerned with his own position that he paradoxically doesn't even notice where he is. Farinata acts as if he is above hell. He has cut himself off so far from other people that he cannot even acknowledge the people he shares his punishment with. All the social graces that this great man once possessed have been perverted. His words are graceful and courteous, yet not out of respect, but condescension. He stands there with his chest and brow proclaiming his disdain for all this hell, like the materialist looking down on all of this superstition. The dead man proclaiming that there is no life after death. In the end, like all the other damned souls, the heretic is characterized by a ruined mind. He cannot connect to where he is. It is thus fitting that one of the major themes of this canto is the ability of the damned souls to remember the past and see into the future, but to be blind to what is happening close to them in time. All the souls in the Inferno have this limited ability, but why does Dante choose to speak of this characteristic now when he is presenting the heretics? Well, let's think about it like this. To be present in the present moment requires us to put aside the accidentals, to stop labeling things, and just be open to the reality before us. But materialists have a skewed sense of the present, focusing, as they do, on the accidentals rather than on the substance of what is there before them. Just as Farinata does not see Dante, just as Farinata does not see Dante, but only the son of a family belonging to the opposing political party. He has boxed himself off from the present, and in fact, if we look at the language Farinata uses, we see that it is full of me, me, me. His world is narrow and extends only as far as his ego will reach. And now that his ego has died, his world reaches nowhere, but only flits around the unreal worlds of the past and the future. And there's another problem. People who confine themselves to boxes are bound to miscommunicate. As we would expect, the damned souls in Canto 10 fail to communicate. In contrast, early in the canto, we see that Virgil knows what Dante is wishing without Dante even having to state his desire. This is true communication, arising out of a deep concern for the other and a reaching out to catch the person's intentions even before they are put into words. Such deep connections are impossible for the two heretics we meet here. Conversation for Farinata is just an opportunity to show how superior he is and to taunt Dante with his party's victories over Dante's party. Dante seems to taunt Farinata in return, and it's true that Dante often does fall into the sin he is visiting. But in fact, if we look carefully, we see that Dante is not trying to score points over Farinata, but simply to correct his incomplete version of the events. And in case we need to correct these events, we'll move over to a little business. At the present moment, you are listening to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105.
An end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
There we are. Cavalcanti, on the other hand, rising from that tomb, serving as a kind of comic turn in the middle of the canto, is the epitome of the bad communicator. His emotions determine the way he hears what other people are saying. What he wants to hear, he hears. We all know people like that. Do we ever think of them as a kind of heretic, boxed into their own narrow version of reality? Cavalcanti's biggest failure is to misrepresent Dante's use of the past tense and presume what Dante meant without bothering to ask for clarification. Dante used the past tense when speaking of Cavalcanti's son Guido, and Cavalcanti immediately assumes that his son was dead. Here we see why it can be so dangerous to do that which is right in our own eyes. We need other people, if only to consult them to help us understand what we most want to find out. Follow that? Shall I say that again? We need other people, if only to consult them to help us understand what we most want to find out, like whether our son is still alive. The comedy of miscommunication then continues when Farinata resumes his conversation with Dante as though Cavalcanti had never spoken. Farinata is too grand to acknowledge any interruption, and this leaves him looking ridiculous, absurdly out of touch with what is taking place. His refusal to acknowledge Cavalcanti is even more odd, pathetically comic, when we remember that the two were machetunum, a Yiddish word I like to use since there is no word in English to express this relationship. Cavalcanti's son Guido married Farinata's daughter. My son marries your daughter. We are machetunum. We should at least acknowledge each other's presence, no? Well, no wonder Virgil cautioned Dante to choose his words with care. In a place where people choose what they want to believe, words become subject to all sorts of abuse. We might expect to turn around and see over there Lewis Carroll's Humpty Dumpty, surely the great heretic of Through the Looking Glass, who tells Alice, "When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." All communication breaks down with this sort of heretical attitude. When it comes to language especially, it is absurd for every man to do what is right in his own eyes. We have to accommodate the community of shared speakers of the language and all agree on what the words mean, as far as this is possible. Before we leave Cavalcanti, let's attend to something he says that can be quite significant. "If you pass through this dark prison by virtue of your lofty genius," he says to Dante, "where is my son, and why is he not with you?" Cavalcanti is indeed blind and imprisoned in his own way of thinking if he supposes that Dante's passing through hell while still alive because of his lofty genius. Cavalcanti thinks this trip to hell is some kind of reward for being such a great poet, when in fact the trip is a corrective experience for someone who has been weak and has failed in his life. These lines come at the very heart of the canto and point out another grave danger of heresy, insecurity. Because heresy isolates the self from the community, it feels a little insecure and seems to need to prove itself. Thus, it values strength and lofty genius. Orthodoxy, though, is secure enough within the community to allow it to be humble and to admit its weakness. I wonder if it follows, then, that although we must all make our own journeys, repentance and transformation can take place only within a community. The heretic who does that which is right in his own eyes cannot take Dante's journey. What could this person learn from the experience? His or her imagination has been turned to stone by Medusa, and thus can look only in one limited angle. I see this sometimes in students reading Dante. Heresy in this sense is common among some students who have intellectual equipment but often insist on reading literature their own way. "I don't see why Dante put Helen of Troy in with the lustful," a student recently said. "Helen didn't feel passion for Paris. He abducted her. It was rape. Why does Dante always blame women for sexual sins?" Now, as long as the student is going to argue like this with the poem, she will always be striving for lofty genius and will never be open to what Dante is saying. There will be a failure of communication typical of what we have seen in Canto 10. If I explain that the Greek myths were not always consistent and Dante chose a version that depicted Helen as a willing lover of Paris because he wanted images of lovers being swept away, out of control, causing great destruction, then this student can shift away from that which is right in her own eyes and come to some agreement with Dante about what it means to be swept along by illicit passion. Her legitimate questions about medieval misogyny still remain, but she is no longer boxed in by them and no longer fighting Dante's text and is now open to how it may move and enlighten her. Okay, now, for a break, let's have a classic song about being boxed in, or rather being stuck inside of Mobile, with the Memphis Blues again. It's a long, intense, playful poem throwing at us one surreal image after another, like the grandfather who built a fire on Main Street and shot it full of holes. But if we attend closely, I think we'll find one image after another describing some form of failed communication, some form of being boxed in with no escape. Is this, then, the heretic's anthem? Maybe, but I get no sense that the singer has made a conscious choice to defy orthodoxy or the right sense of reality. So why is he stuck inside of Mobile? I think this song describes the absurd existentialist world where no authority has any credence, and so there is no orthodoxy, no sense of what is real. Dante wouldn't call this heresy, perhaps, but we can see the connections in a twisted 1960s way. So here's Bob Dylan, stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again, an alternate version from the bootleg Cutting Edge album. A little snappier, a little less articulate, a little more reeling from the meaningless confusion of the world than the usual version.
Oh, the ragman draws circles up and down the block. I'd ask him what the matter was, but I know he doesn't talk. And the ladies treat me kindly and furnish me with tape, but neither him nor the ragman can help me to escape. Oh, mama, this could be the end. I'm stuck inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now Shakespeare's in the alley with his pointed shoes and his bells, speaking to some French girl who says she knows me well. And I would send a message to find out if she talks, but the post office has been stolen and the mailbox is locked. Oh, mama, this might be the end. I'm stuck inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now, Mona tried to help me. She said, stay away from the train line. She said, all the railroad men do is drink your blood like wine. And I said, oh, I don't know. But then again, there's only one I met, and he just smoked my eyebags and punched my cigarette. Oh, mama, this might be the end. I'm stuck inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Well, Grandpa died last week. He's buried in the rocks. Everybody's still talking about how badly he was shot. And me, I expected it. I saw he lost control when he built a fire on Main Street and filled it full of holes. Oh, mama, this might be the end. I'm stuck inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now the senator came down here with showing everyone his gun, handing out free tickets to the wedding of his son. And I nearly got busted. Wouldn't it be my luck to get caught without a ticket and be discovered near the truck? Oh, mama, this might be the end. I'm stuck inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Well, the preacher looks so baffled every time I ask him why he dressed with 20 pounds of headlines stapled on his chest. He'd curse me when I'd whisper and say, you're not eating high. You see, you're just like me. I hope you're satisfied. Oh, mama, this might be the end. I'm stuck inside a Mobile. Yes, we lose again. Two cures, and he said, jump right in. One was Texas medicine, the other was railroad gin. And like a fool, I mixed them, and it strangled up my mind. And now people just get uglier, and I have no sense of time. Oh, mama, I just need a friend. Stuck inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
Oh, mama, the song ends. I just need a friend, stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Yes, being a heretic is to live in a world without real friends, isn't it? We would expect that a canto dedicated to exposing the sin of heresy would address the sin itself in some way. But it's typical of Dante that he presents us with something that at first seems off the point, but when after further consideration, it opens up indirectly new understandings of the main topic. So we find here that Dante spends much of the canto writing about the factional wars between the Ghibellines, the aristocratic party that supported the emperor, and the Guelphs, the party that supported the pope, to oversimplify this complex historical conflict. The power plays between these two parties split Florence and the areas around it in the generations just before Dante's, and were responsible for the further factional battles that eventually led to Dante's exile from Florence. Why should Dante choose to speak about this issue in the Circle of the Heretics? Two aspects of the battles come to mind. First of all, this strife was the most vivid example Dante could have chosen to illustrate the way party politics create divisions and disrupt the unity and community of a society. One side fights another, the one in power throws out the defeated party, and a little later the fortunes change, and a new party in power exiles the other. Can this also be an image of heresy? Instead of stressing the points that unite heretics, and of course those who oppose the heretics too, focus on divisions, and more specifically on overpowering those who do not share their position. So I hope we are beginning to see more clearly why heresy is hellish. I'm not saying that instead of heresy, we should just mindlessly accept an orthodox position without argument. No. What I'm suggesting, in the light of Dante's canto, is that if we disagree with another person's views, instead of entrenching ourselves in our own views, we should reach out, first of all, to discover what we may have in common with the other person before we take up arms to fight them. If we look for what assumptions and beliefs we share, we will be communicating, and we may discover in the end that we are not as different as we had supposed. We will not, like Farinata, look with scorn at opponents or drop out of sight in despair like Cavalcanti just because we have not bothered to examine what the other person has meant. We will break out of our boxes and come together. Sure, there may be times when we discover irreconcilable differences, and perhaps we will have to fight. But that is a last resort, and we come to that position by examining closely the positions facing us in the present, not by holding fast to long-standing preconceptions that can only distort what lies before us. Oh, one more thing before we finish. Towards the end of the canto, Dante provides us with two moments that demonstrate the virtuous and humble alternative to heresy. The first comes after Dante realizes why Cavalcanti did not know that his son Guido was still alive, and he asks Farinata to clear up the misunderstanding when he descends back into the tomb with Cavalcanti. There does not seem much hope that Farinata will do this, but that's not the point. When we realize there has been some miscommunication, our obligation and our desire is to make amends as best we can. The second moment comes as Virgil and Dante leave the heretics. Dante is pondering on the words of Farinata, hinting that he will be sent into exile in less than 50 months. No wonder Dante is disturbed. What is worse, he exhibits the optical deformity of the damned souls, looking forward into the future instead of being present in the moment. Virgil speaks firmly to Dante, even raising an emphatic finger. He tells Dante to remember the words, but not to be preoccupied right now. Things will be explained in good time, not in the way that is right in Dante's eyes, but according to Providence's will. And Dante, having successfully passed through the region of the heretics, says no more, but proceeds in the present moment on his journey to salvation. The journey leads next to those who were violent to others, suffering in the boiling blood of the river Phlegethon, whose stench arose, disgusting us as high up as we were. the next step on after heresy, we are not surprised to discover, is violence towards others. And the stink of this violence seeps in to pollute the heresy itself. So that's Canto 10 of Dante's Inferno, about heretics, about being boxed in, about party politics, about not living in the present, and about miscommunications. And with that, this is Robert Louis Abrahamson thanking you for tuning in to Evening Under Lamplight here at Cambridge 105. You can reach me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And I wish you a good night. See you next time.